Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin with us this hour. Of course, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and the Jimmy Akin podcast, and you know him from a lot of other things. Sometimes we get all the questions, not all the questions, but lots of questions together from the internet, and we ask them of Jimmy, and that's what we're going to continue to do this hour. Thanks for coming back, Jimmy.
Oh, my pleasure. Happy to be here.
I'm really glad to see this next question comes from High King Turgon, the king of Gondolin.
Don't get to hear from him too often.
No, especially since the big war. It's nice to hear from Turgon again. And Turgon says, this is from a friend. All right. Another elf wants to know, I kind of want to convert. Oh, the friend says, I kind of want to convert, but Eucharistic ministers' hands touching hands and tongues and sharing the chalice are so yucky. What can I do about this hang-up?
Get over it. I mean, that's kind of the fundamental answer, but I can build that out a little bit to try to be of more help, which is what I want to be. Now, High King Turgon's friend says that he's concerned about Eucharistic ministers' hands, and I'm not sure if there's a kind of a preliminary issue I need to address. Now, the proper term is not Eucharistic ministers, but what most people mean by that term is extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion, as opposed to the ordinary ministers, which are priests, bishops, priests, deacons, and instituted acolytes. And so I'm not sure, this is the first issue, I'm not sure if King Turgon's friend is drawing a distinction here between the hands of priests and other ordinary ministers of Holy Communion and the hands of lay people who are not, you know, ordained or not instituted acolytes, who are extraordinary ministers. But frankly, there's no difference in terms of their hands. I mean, maybe someone has said a special blessing over a priest's hand, but that didn't change its that didn't fundamentally change the quality of your hand. And so the only rational basis that I could think of for regarding an extraordinary minister's hands touching tongues and so forth as being yucky would be based on, you know, concerns about germs. And those are going to apply to a priest's hands just as much as anybody else's. So I wouldn't draw a distinction on that subject. I think all humans we're all covered in germs. That's just part of life as a human. In fact, we're designed to be covered in germs and to actually have germs inside of us, not just on us, but we have our own personal microbiome that contains helpful germs, in fact, both in our guts and on our skin. And that's one reason you don't want to overuse, like with skin, you don't want to overuse sanitizers, because in addition to killing off the bad germs in your skin microbiome, you're also killing off the good ones that you need to help protect you. And so I wouldn't distinguish between priests and anybody else when it comes to this germ issue. We're all humans. We're all covered in germs. And that's the way it's meant to be. So I would say, to that extent, one shouldn't have a unique concern about extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion, because the same thing is going to apply to priests. And I suspect that this kind of germ direction is what High King Turgon's friend is thinking about, because the friend says that the friend is concerned about their hands touching other people's hands and tongues and sharing the chalice, and that's what's yucky. So it seems to be this germ direction that the friend is thinking about. Mm. Okay, so fine. So let's take the question on in those terms. In the case of sharing the chalice, which is a common way that the precious blood is distributed in the Latin Rite in this country, I think that there can be grounds for some concern here, because what they typically do is a minister of Holy Communion maybe a deacon, let's say, will be holding the chalice, and they'll let someone drink from it, and then they'll turn the chalice. They'll use a purificator to wipe the edge of the chalice, and then they'll turn it a quarter turn and give it to someone else. So what that means is, after the fourth person in line, you're drinking from the same part of the chalice as somebody else, even though it's been wiped with a purificator. And, well, purificators are purificators. They do remove many of the germs that are there, but they don't remove them all. And so I think that especially during cold and flu seasons, there can be a rational basis for not receiving from the chalice. And for germaphobes who have those concerns year round, well, if you don't want to receive from the chalice, well, then don't. You know, you don't have to. In fact, I'll confess, I tend to be something of a germaphobe myself. I'm not as bad as I used to be when I was a kid, but I'm not required to receive from the chalice, and I don't. My own personal preference for how to receive communion is with a form of distribution known as intinction. And what happens in intinction is the priest takes whoever's distributing, but typically the priest, takes a host and dips it in the precious blood and then puts it directly onto your tongue. And if I had my druthers, and I'd rather have my druthers, to quote Little Abner, I would receive by intinction every single time. But intinction is not that common in the United States, especially with the current edition of the Roman Missal. So I don't normally get to do that. So what I do instead is I tend to receive only under the form of bread. I receive the host, but not the chalice. So let's look at the distribution of the host in terms of the germ transmission potential. Well, King Turgon's friend is concerned about ministers of the Holy Eucharist touching people's hands and tongues. But I think that concern should not be as great as the friend is thinking, because we have two modes of distribution of communion here, putting the host on the tongue and putting the host in the hand. Well, okay, ministers of Holy Communion, whether they're ordinary or extraordinary, they don't usually touch people's hands when they distribute Holy Communion. They typically hold the host between their thumb and forefinger, and they place it in the person's hand if the person comes up with their hands out. You know, they say the body of Christ, and then they put it in the person's hand, but they don't usually touch the person's hand. They also, if you notice, and this is very common these days, I see this all the time, whoever the minister of Holy Communion is, ordinary or extraordinary, they tend to use hand sanitizer right before they distribute. And so, they don't really touch people's hands, and people's hands, although they can have germs on them, the chance of transmission of something harmful after the minister of Holy Communion has just hand sanitized and isn't really touching other people's hands, it's pretty low. The same thing I think is true for distribution on the tongue. Because now I recognize it's a little different, but I don't think it's very high in that case either. Now, personally, this is just my preference. I have no problem if people want to receive in the hand, but my preference is to receive on the tongue, and I always receive on the tongue. So when I go up to Holy Communion, I open my mouth and they say the body of Christ, I say amen, and then I open my mouth nice and wide. And I note, I do that, and I stick my tongue out, and I do that partially because I've got facial hair around my mouth, and I want to make it easy for the minister of Holy Communion to place the host on my tongue. And what I can tell you doing that over and over and over again is they very seldom touch my tongue. It's just very rare that would happen. I can't say it never happens, but it's very, very rare. What I will occasionally feel is the host may brush my whiskers, you know, like in my mustache, but they just don't touch my tongue. I mean, it can happen, but it's very rare. And so I would say that the odds of getting something problematic from, you know, some kind of disease from germs involving the transmission of the distribution of the host, whether it's via the hand or on the tongue, is just very, very low. And so I would say that that I wouldn't worry about it, because what you're getting is Jesus himself. And so I would say to the friend of High King Turgon who wants to convert, go ahead and convert, and then you can receive Jesus Christ himself, and you get all the benefits of receiving Jesus Christ himself. And compared to the minimal chances of catching some kind of disease, I would say it's totally worth it. So in terms of the germ concerns, if you don't want to receive the chalice, especially during cold and flu season, well, then just don't. And the odds of disease transmission via receiving the host in the standard ways it's distributed today are just vanishingly low and do not compare to the benefits of receiving Jesus.
Hi, King Turgon. Thank you very much. I hope that was helpful to both you and your friend. We got to take a quick break. Jimmy Akin, our guest, back with more questions from the internet right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Catholic Influencers is a great podcast from Australia. It studies the weekly readings and breaks them down into layman's terms, showing you how they're relevant to our life today, making theology accessible for everyone. You can hear Catholic Influencers as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world, all in one place, all free at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio and click Podcast Central today.
Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour on Catholic Answers Live, and all of our questions have come from the internet. It's an internet ask me anything. This one comes from TJ. Do you have a response to Dr. Mark Miravalli's response about Medjugorje?
Okay, so I should probably explain what this is referring to.
Okay.
A few months ago, late last year, the Vatican finally published a ruling on Medjugorje. And I'd had people asking me about Medjugorje for years and years and years, but I hadn't really dug into it in a lot of depth, in part because I knew this response was in preparation, that the Vatican was going to be coming out with a ruling at some point, and I didn't want to do a whole bunch of research and then deal with it. I'd rather wait till the ruling came out, and then I could react to the ruling. So that's what I did. And they finally came out with a ruling on Medjugorje, and they didn't really address the issue head on of, is it supernatural or not, because they tend not to address that these days. It requires special authorization of the Pope to actually look into that question and make that determination. But they did come out with a, given that it didn't deal with the issue of supernaturality, it was a pretty positive one. You know, they said you need to set aside certain things, you need to understand certain things in a kind of careful way, but you can incorporate Medjugorje elements into your spirituality. And so that's what I talked about. I did for only the second time ever, I did a three-parter on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where I looked in the first episode at the history of the Medjugorje reported apparitions. In the second episode, I looked at the Vatican ruling on them and went through that and what it said and didn't say. And then, because I knew people wanted to know my own opinion about is it supernatural or not, I went into that question in the third episode, and I made it totally clear. This is just my tentative opinion. I'm not wedded to this, but I tentatively came to a conclusion that was similar to the one that the Ruini Commission in Rome had come to, which was that the earliest Medjugorje apparitions were likely to be supernatural, but that the later ones were not. And so, but I could go either way on that, you know. So I'm not wedded to that position, and I don't have any problem if anyone disagrees with it. Well, Dr. Mark Miravalli of the University of Steubenville is a noted Mariologist, and he's also a noted supporter of Medjugorje, and he has been for decades. So he's a big proponent of the idea that Medjugorje is supernatural, and that's fine. He then did his own video on YouTube where he responds to me, and that's totally fine too. I watched his video. I don't have any plans at the moment to respond to it. I think that I stand by the conclusions I came to. I don't think anything he said gave me reason to change, you know, the tentative conclusion I've come to. Certainly I don't think that it would lead me, what he said would lead me to conclude his position, which is that the apparitions are all supernatural. I just don't see good evidence for that. I see significant evidence against that. He was very charitable, especially towards the beginning of his response. He said nice things about me. He acknowledged that I'm trying to do a good job here and be fair and balanced. And I acknowledge, you know, the same thing for him. He's a noted scholar. He's as entitled to his opinions. He's trying to do good in the world. I think all that's true. He said he didn't want to find fault with me on a moral, personal level, although I think that as you listen to him towards the end of his response, he actually does start to do that a little bit. But, you know, that's that. And he thought I accused him similarly of some personal moral faults. I actually didn't intend to do that. I made some observations that I understand how he could take them that way. It wasn't my intent to do that. And if I caused any confusion in that, I apologize. But given the difference of opinion here and the fact that I don't think that the material was devastating or anything like that, my inclination is to let the two things stand. You know, I said my piece, he said his piece, and I'm comfortable in a marketplace of ideas where people can look at both cases and make up their own minds. So I don't have and if I did have a response, you know, it might descend into a little bit more personal judgments, which is actually what I want to avoid. So I'm more inclined to just, we both said our piece, people can watch what we said and make up their own minds, and I'm fine with that.
Thank you very much, TJ, for the question. We got time for another one. Before I got to take a break, we'll go to Melissa's question. Jimmy, I heard you state on a recent podcast that you have a particular interest in linguistics, so I'm hoping you can comment on the following issue. Why are some Old Testament names so familiar in modern English and others so foreign to us? Is it a matter of translation, the importance of the person, or something else?
Well, it is, and this is something I'm interested in. In fact, I once thought about getting a master's in linguistics just because I find the subject so interesting. And I read books about linguistics, and linguists have studied baby naming conventions a lot. And there's a lot of really interesting stuff. Like, for example, sometimes people will think that celebrities or famous characters on TV shows or in movies influence baby naming trends. Like, you know, for example, our own producer is Darren. And some people thought that the name of Samantha Stevens' husband, Darren, on Bewitched, the 1960s sitcom, made the name Darren popular as a baby name. But when you actually study the census records that tell you, and birth certificates that show exactly when names were being made, were being given to babies, the causality is not always what people would think. For example, in the case of Darren, it looks like it wasn't Bewitched. It was the fact that, and this was more a phenomenon in England than America, as I recall, but the names that ended with the sound in, like Darren, they were just becoming more popular on their own before Bewitched ever came along. And so it looks like Bewitched didn't influence the name Darren. The reason Darren got popular was because it was part of a class of names that had that in final sound that were already becoming popular on their own. So there have correspondingly been studies of biblical names and their popularities over time. And the reason that some are more popular than others is partly due to, now Melissa mentioned some possibilities. She says, is it a matter of translation or the importance of the person or something else? Well, I think it's all three. One of the things is it's partly a matter of the translation, because these names, these biblical names, are don't sound exactly in Hebrew and Greek the way they do in English. And so you can bring them into English in multiple different ways. For example, the root name that I have in, I mean, my name is Jimmy. That's my legal name. It's on my birth certificate. It's a Texas thing. But the name, the Hebrew name that Jimmy comes from is Yaakov. And almost nobody today hears the name Yaakov. That would be very unfamiliar to an ordinary English speaker. You don't hear many people in America named Yaakov. You may hear some people named Jacob or Jacob or things like that, or James, another variation of the name. You don't hear so many named Jimmy, although it is a common nickname. It's not as common as a legal name. But translation is one of the reasons. If you translate Yaakov one way, just bring it straight into English, it's going to be unfamiliar. But if you translate it James, it's going to be much more familiar. So translation is part of it. Another part of it is the importance of the person that it's named after. We have a patriarch named Yaakov in the Old Testament, but we translate that Jacob. And because of how prominent Jacob is in the Old Testament, a lot of people have named their kids Jacob. We then bring the same name into English as James, and we use that when we're doing the New Testament. So you have, you know, two Jameses among the 12 apostles, plus James, the Lord's brother. So we've got multiple Jameses in the New Testament. Two of them, James, the son of Zebedee, and James the Just, are very prominent. And so because of that prominence, you know, people are more likely to name their kid James than after some minor biblical figure. Like until a few years ago, almost nobody had heard of the Old Testament figure Jabez. And so there were very few people named Jabez, lots of people named James. And then Melissa mentioned something else. Yeah, there are other factors too. It's not just the translation. It's not just the importance of the person. There are also historical cycles that names follow. With some names like Max, it's been noted that Max is kind of a prominent example of one of these cycles. Until recently, everybody named Max was really old. It was common a few generations ago, but it became much less common. And then it started to become more popular again. And so today, the name Max is common in old folks' homes and kindergartens, but not so much in the middle. Stephen is kind of the opposite. Stephen used to be a rare name. Then it became very popular in the mid-20th century. Then it dropped off again. And so now Stephens tend to be adults. There are not as many in the old folks' homes and the kindergartens. But then there are some names like James and John that, in the words of one linguist, just will not go away. And so they tend to be with us always. So it's a combination of different factors.
Oh, fascinating. Melissa, thank you very much for the question. Crazy Dove. Is that right? Crazy Dove or Crazy Dove?
Yeah.
I'm going to go with Crazy Dove.
Either way.
I don't even know what this question means, so you have to tell me. What's the best evidence that psi phenomenon exists?
Okay. So psi is an abbreviation. It's not an abbreviation. It's a term that was invented in the 20th century to refer to psychic phenomena.
Oh, all right.
So if someone is claiming to display ESP, extrasensory perception, or they're claiming to be able to display psychokinesis or PK, which is mind over matter, then both of those would be examples of psi. The term psi doesn't mean anything. It's just the 23rd letter of the Greek alphabet. It's not an acronym for anything. And the 23rd letter was picked because it's the first letter in the Greek word psuche, which means mind or soul or consciousness. And since psychic abilities are supposed to be produced by the mind or soul or consciousness, it got picked as just an easy way to refer to them. So that's what psi phenomena are. And in terms of the best evidence, I'll talk about that on the other side of the break.
You can hear that music playing. It's a very short break, though. So if you want to find out what the best evidence for these psychic phenomena are, you just hang on. We'll be right back with Jimmy Akin. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers. And now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Crazy Dove. First, we needed Jimmy to explain to us what the question meant. What's the best evidence for psi phenomenon, that psi phenomenon exists, and that just psychic phenomena of different kinds. And so what is the best evidence, Jimmy?
Well, I think that so the best evidence is always statistical in nature, in science. And so what you want to do is you want to look at big pools of data that have generated, and not just one experiment. You want to look at multiple experiments that have been done and see, you know, what kind of evidence they provide. Now, there are several very large pools of data that have been generated looking at psi phenomena. One is, and you know, that has been replicated. So this is not, these are not just single studies. These are things that look at multiple, very large numbers of trials. One is a set of trials that were done at the Princeton Engineering Anomalies, or PAIR lab. They did work both on remote viewing, and which is a form of clairvoyance, and on psychokinesis. And they generated really startling numbers. Now, in the sciences in general, the 5 sigma threshold level, a sigma is the number of standard deviations away from the average that you have. And so nothing is statistically significant until it hits two standard deviations. At that point, you've got a 1 in 20 chance of the phenomena being showing a 1 in 20 chance of the results being random. But there's still that 1 in 20 chance that they're just random, that there's no real phenomenon here. So 2 sigma is kind of considered the minimal threshold for statistical significance. By the time you get to 5 sigma, it is like millions to 1 against against this just being random. And so kind of the gold standard that's used in many areas of science, like in physics, is if you've got five sigma significance, then you can announce a discovery. You know, we've really shown this. It's real. It's real. It is not just random. It is, the odds are millions to one that further research would overturn this finding. Mm-hmm. Well, there have been series of psi experiments that have shown greater than 5 sigma significance, like 6 sigma, 7 sigma, things like that. And the Princeton Engineer and Anomalies Lab is one of the places that has generated that. Another is a series of experiments that were initially done by a psychiatrist named Daryl Bem, B-E-M, who was not initially he didn't initially do work in parapsychology, but he was a very famous experimentalist who designed, who was very good with experimental design, and he was asked to comment on the experimental design of some parapsychological experiments, and he got interested in the field and started doing his own experiments. And what he did was he would take ordinary experiments that had been done in regular psychology and like make one little tweak in them that would turn them into a parapsychological experiment. So for example, one of the experiments he did, there were like 11 of them, but one of the things he did was he took a memory test from ordinary psychology. And the way this memory test works is they read you a list of random words, and then they divide the list in two, and they give you half of the list, and you get to practice that half of the list. And then they do the test. So they've read you the full list, they've let you practice half the list, and then they test you on how many of the words you can remember. And it turns out, no surprise, you remember the ones that you were able to practice better than you remember the ones you were not able to practice. So that's the way the memory test ordinarily works in standard psychology. And they have all the, you know, techniques for how to statistically evaluate the results. But this is the way the test works. It's not controversial. So what Daryl Bem then does is he flips the order of two steps. So in his version, first they read you the words, the list as a whole, then they test you on what you remember, and then they let you practice half the list. So you're actually doing the practice after you've been tested on what you remember. And it still turns out you remember the ones you would practice in the future better than the ones you would not practice in the future. It's like you're doing your homework after you've taken the test. And with this series of 11 experiments, now he ended up publishing a paper in a mainstream psychiatric journal on this. This wasn't some special publication. It was a very respected mainstream journal. It was called Feel in the Future. And he covered these 11 experiments, and he got statistically significant results in a bunch of them. And almost, I think, all but one or something like that. And he got very high statistical significance. And people said, oh, this is impossible. This can't possibly be real. This all has to be replicated. Well, it so happens that what Daryl Bem had done was program his experiments into a computer package that anybody could download and run on their own computer. And so that's what people did. After Feel in the Future, they started downloading this computer package, running the same experiments in their own labs, and they got the same results. And so you got extraordinarily high statistical significance for this. And, you know, people started writing articles with titles like Daryl Bim Has Broken Science, because he was using standard statistical means of evaluating these test results, and they were still producing results that materialists could not accept. And so I think that's really good evidence for psi. So I mentioned the Pear Lab. I mentioned Daryl Bim. Also, I mentioned the Stargate program, which was a program that the Defense Department operated. It involved, again, remote viewing or clairvoyance. It was run between the 1970s and the 1990s. And at the end of the project, the CIA, which was then in charge of it, it had left the Defense Department, wanted a statistical review done. Now, they'd really already decided they were going to close it down, but they wanted a statistical review done. And so they hired two individuals to do that review. One was Professor Jessica Utz, who is a statistician, and she's even been the head of the American Statistical Association. So she's very highly qualified, and she's open to psi. The other individual they hired was a skeptic. He's a psychiatrist named Ray Hyman. And so they had both, they wanted both perspectives, someone who's open and someone who's skeptical, and they had them review the evidence. And they only had a limited time. They could only look at a limited selection of the data. But Jessica Utz, in her evaluation, concluded psi has been proved as effectively as anything else in science, that the data is just there, that it exists, in her view. So that was the open person's position. What about the skeptic? Ray Hyman, in his evaluation, concluded that based on the Stargate data that they reviewed, that the evidence looks as promising for psi as it's ever looked, that it deserves further research. And even though Hyman at the time was not willing to say that psi has been proven, he said it looks extremely promising that it does, and he could change his opinion in the future if further research bore out the results of the Stargate program. So I would say that so I tend to cite that one because you've got a skeptic even admitting, I could change my mind on this because this looks really promising. So those would be three examples of positive evidence for the existence of psi in a scientific setting. Of course, there's no church teaching on this. So this is a matter of science, not a matter of doctrine. And if you think the scientific evidence supports psi, then that's fine. But if you think the scientific evidence does not support psi, that's fine too.
Crazy Dove, thank you for that question. I appreciate it very much. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back. We'll get some more questions to Jimmy Akin. Before we have to go, it's an internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin today on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1999. The shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament of Our Lady of the Angels Monastery in Hansville, Alabama is consecrated. Mother Angelica says, "The happiest day of my life was the day this church was dedicated."
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul? And that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Having fun with internet questions. Lots of great, great questions. And this one comes from TallyTie0326. If angels have been around since creation, but they don't reproduce, does that mean that it's the same number of angels since the beginning, no more and no less?
Well, prima facie, or on the face of things, that would seem to be the case. They don't reproduce, and they're immortal, so they don't pass out of existence, and that would be the, if you assume that they've all been around since creation, then it would seem that we've had the same number all the way down through history. Now, that's not, there are some possibilities that could deviate from that, like what if they haven't all been around since creation? What if God makes them in batches, you know, at different points in history? Well, then there could be more of them. They may not reproduce, but God may create more of them. And mm-hmm. so that would be a possibility. That possibility does not have a lot of traction in Judeo-Christian thought. It tends to be assumed that they all got made at the same time. In fact, the non-canonical book of Jubilees, it's either Jubilees or First Enoch, but I think it's Jubilees, says that like God made them all at the same time during creation week. He made all the spirits that exist, including human spirits, but he made all the spirits that exist wham on one day in creation week, and they've all been around since. And some of them, like humans, have gotten bodies, but angels don't. The only place I can think of in Judeo-Christian tradition which has envisioned new angels coming into existence is in the book of First Enoch, where Enoch, and I'm sure there are other examples too that are along these lines, but it's not in canonical literature. In Enoch, the biblical patriarch Enoch, who is a human, is sort of transmogrified or transubstantiated so that he actually becomes an angel. Specifically, as I recall, he becomes the angel Metatron. But even though that idea, the idea of humans kind of getting their wings, like Clarence in It's a Wonderful Life, has been there a little bit, this is not a prominent opinion, and it's certainly not something in Scripture. But hypothetically, if God makes angels in some other way, you know, like creating them out of nothing or transmogrifying another being into an angel, then you could get more angels over time, provided it's done in stages after the creation. When it comes to the same number of angels remaining, well, okay, one thing that's obvious is that some angels are now demons, and that's because they fell into sin. And it's historically been common to assume in Christian circles that that all happened at once. But if you want to say a demon, even though they're the same species, if I can put it that way, if you wanted to say that demons are, you're not going to count demons as angels, well, then we did lose a bunch of angels. And the standard account is that happened all at once, but there are other versions. In fact, it seems in the Hebrew scriptures and in Second Temple literature that it's assumed that the angels did not fall all at once, but that they fell in different stages. And St. Paul even seems to possibly envision a future stage where some angels might fall. That's not the traditional Christian view, but it is something that has to be thought about. But with angels turning into demons, that's just one possibility. Another possibility that would decrease the number of angels is if God annihilated some of them so that they cease to exist. But that idea really doesn't have a lot of traction in, I mean, there are some individuals who may be annihilationists and will say that when God punishes the angels on the last day, they might be annihilated. That is not the Catholic Church's understanding. But there may be some people in the Judeo-Christian tradition who, more broadly, who would hold that. But I can't think of any books off the top of my head that actively endorse that possibility. There may be some. But normally it's understood that their punishment is going to be everlasting rather than annihilationist in nature. But I'd have to do a review of the literature to say with certainty.
All right. Tally Ty, thank you very much for the question. This next one comes from Stephen. How do those who desperately want a relationship with God, including prayers inviting all three persons of God to come into their heart, deal properly with an apparent lack of response from God?
Well, so this is something that I think everybody deals with to some extent, because there are all times when we want things from God, like a feeling of closeness to Him, that we don't immediately have. And so I think this is something everybody can sympathize with, because we all go through this at various points. The way I would say to deal with it is just trust Him.
There are times where, oh, sure, I'd love to have a vibrant experience of the presence of God, but I don't need that in order to get through life. What I need is for God to take care of me. And so I will assume that, you know, I'll pray to God, and then I'll just trust Him and say, He'll give me whatever I need. If it's going to help me to have a powerful experience of His presence, I'd love to have that. You know, I definitely welcome that, but I'm not going to worry about it if I don't get that, because what I ultimately need is His care, not a powerful demonstration of His presence. And so I tend to not focus on my own emotions, on my own feelings. I treat emotions as things that if they come and I have a powerful emotional experience of God, well, that's wonderful. But I'm not going to expect it or demand it out of Him. I can live comfortably not having such experiences, and I would treat any ones that do come along as gifts, as, you know, as really nice things that God has done for me. But I don't expect or demand it, and I don't let it distress me if I don't have those experiences. And so I tend to partition my emotions. I mean, I have good evidence that God exists. And I do have a relationship with Him. I talk to Him and He cares for me. But I don't let it worry me that I don't have particular kinds of particular manifestations of a relationship, like one where I feel a powerful sense of His presence. That's something that will come and go with time, but it shouldn't bug me if I don't have it at the moment. What's ultimately important is, does God exist? Well, yes, He does. I've got good evidence for that. Does He care for me? Yes, He does. I've got good evidence for that. And do I trust Him to take care of me? And the answer is, yes, He does. I've got good evidence for that. So if I get emotional, warm feelings on top of that, that's a bonus, but it's not a requirement, because the important things are already taken care of. It's kind of like that old Rolling Stones song, you can't always get what you want, but if you try, you can get what you need. And what we need is God's providential care of us, and we'll have the wonderful, glorious emotional experiences in the future, and perhaps some in this life, but we'll definitely have them in the next life. And for now, we just need to press on and do what we can to love and serve God and our fellow human beings.
Stephen, thank you for that question. Next one comes from Pamela. How can days off purgatory be understood in the hereafter, since we live in a different, quote, time zone? And isn't the time frame of the purging a discretionary matter only God can determine?
Okay, so let's answer Pamela's second question first. Isn't the time frame of judging purgatory something only God can determine? Yes, that would be the understanding, for example, of Pope Benedict XVI in his encyclical on Christian hope, Spes Salvi. When he talks about purgatory, he says it cannot be calculated in earthly time. So that's something only God can determine. We can't calculate it using our current systems of timekeeping. And that is why the church eliminated, back in the 1960s under Pope Paul VI, it eliminated the quote-unquote days that were associated with various indulgences, because they had come to be misunderstood. What those days, like let's say you had an indulgence of 300 days, what that meant was that your purgation would be relieved of the amount of penance equivalent to doing 300 days of penance here on earth. But what that meant in purgatory, nobody has any idea, because that's up to God. And so these were equivalents of earthly days of penance. but people didn't understand them that way. And so they had the idea, oh, I'm getting days off in purgatory. If I have a 300-day indulgence, that means I get out of purgatory 300 days earlier. And people misunderstood that. So the church decided, let's get rid of those days because people are interpreting them as days off purgatory, and we can't say that that's what they are. We can, you know, judge the strength of an indulgence in terms of what's it equivalent to in earthly days of penance, but we have no idea that that corresponds to time in purgatory. So precisely because only God can determine lengths of time or whatever in purgatory, the church eliminated the days in purgatory from indulgences to get rid of the idea that you're getting this number of days off in purgatory.
Pamela, I hope that was helpful to you. On we go to Katina's question. The Copenhagen experiment.
Oh, she's got such a good name, Katina Last.
Oh, I
4955.
I should have done the whole name. Sorry, Katina. Katina says this: the Copenhagen experiment, where they shot photons through slits. I think I have that right. And the particles behaved differently when they were observed versus unobserved. Does this offer any proof for God? Also, how does this work with weeping angels?
Okay, so this is what Katina is describing is what's known as a double slit experiment. The Copenhagen interpretation is one interpretation of the results of quantum mechanical experiments, but there are other interpretations besides that. So it's not the Copenhagen experiment, but this class of experiment is known as a double slit experiment. And it's true that if you fire particles that have quantum mechanical properties through the different slits, and you watch them or don't watch them, it influences the results of the experiment. So if you watch them to know which slit they're going through, then they're going to display properties as if they're particles. But if you don't watch what slit they go through, they're going to display properties like they're a wave. And so this is known as the wave-particle duality. You either get particle-like results or you get like wave-like results, depending on whether you measure whether they're going through the slit, which slit or not. Now, there are a lot of variations on that, but that's the basic idea of this experiment. So Katina asks, does this give us any proof for God? And the answer is maybe. The question is going to depend on the interpretation of quantum mechanics that you believe is true. And there are a whole bunch of different interpretations. None of them are definitive at this point. There's a robust debate in physics about what's the correct interpretation of quantum mechanics. But there have been some physicists like Eugene Wigner who believed that the operation of consciousness is essential to the phenomena that we observe in the universe, because Wigner would say if you don't have a conscious observer, then you wouldn't see what we actually see in the universe. So like the moon needs a conscious observer to collapse from being just a possible set of states to an actual moon that's in a particular location. And one could then make an argument, and actually Wigner did argue in this way, that you need a kind of cosmic consciousness in order to produce the universe that we see around us. And I have a similar argument that I pose in my book, A Daily Defense, where I propose for consideration a quantum mechanical argument for the existence of God that proceeds along lines similar to Wigner's argument. On the other hand, not everybody has this interpretation. When it comes to weeping angels, the problem with them is they are quantum locked if you're looking at them. And that doesn't really tell us anything about the existence of God. It only tells us that if you see a weeping angel, don't blink.
All right. Katina, thank you very much for the question. Thanks to everybody who got their question to Jimmy one way or another. Jimmy Akin, thank you. Enjoyed the 2 hours.
My pleasure. And don't blink. Don't blink.
I can't not blink if you say don't blink. All right, well, that'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live. I'm trying not to blink.